Hello again. This is Mrs. English, and I am back to read you Book 9 from the Richmond Latimore translation of Homer's Odyssey. Homer's Odyssey, the Richmond Latimore translation, Book 9. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered him, "O great Alcinous, preeminent among all people, surely indeed it is a good thing to listen to a singer such as this one before us, who is like the gods in his singing, for I think there is no occasion accomplished that's more pleasant than when festivity holds sway among all the populace, and the feasters up and down the houses are sitting in order and listening to the singer, and beside them the tables are loaded with breads and meat, and from the mixing bowl the wine steward draws the wine and carries it about and fills the cups. This seems to my own mind to be the best of occasions. But now your wish was inclined to ask me about my mournful sufferings, so that I must mourn and grieve even more. What then shall I recite to you first of all? What leave till later? Many are the sorrows the gods of the sky have given me. Now first I will tell you my name, so that all of you may know me, and I hereafter, escaping the day without pity, be your friend and guest, though the home where I live is far away from you." Line 19. "I am Odysseus, son of Laertes, known before all men for the study of crafty designs." Remember that Athena is Odysseus's patron goddess, and her mother is Metis, and Odysseus also has this trait. "And my fame, my Kleos, goes up to the heavens." He is thrilled that even these people far, far away from his homeland know the story and know it accurately, that the horse was his idea. It was because of Odysseus that Troy was won and sacked. "I am at home in sunny Ithaca. There is a mountain there that stands tall. And now Odysseus is giving us the description of Ithaca. And of course scholars through the ages have attempted to find Ithaca by the description found in lines 19 to 28. And these are the lines. "There is a mountain there that stands tall, leaf-trembling Neritus, and there are islands settled around it, line one very close to another. There is Dulichion and Same, wooded Xenithus, but my island lies low and away, last of all on the water toward the dark, with the rest below facing east and sunshine. A rugged place, but a good nurse of men. For my part, I cannot think of any place sweeter on earth to look at." And, of course, men have tried to find where is this Ithaca, and you have an article on that with that the new book that was written just a couple of years ago, the Odysseus Unbound. "For in truth, Calypso, shining among divinities, kept me with her in her hollow caverns, desiring me for her husband, and so likewise Aeaean, Circe, the guileful, detained me beside her in her halls, desiring me for her husband. But never could she persuade the heart within me. So it is that nothing is more sweet in the end than country and parents ever, even when far away one lives in a fertile place, when it is in an alien country far from his parents. But come, line 37, I will tell you of my voyage home with its many troubles, which Zeus inflicted on me as I came from Troyland." And now Odysseus, as he tells the story to the Phaeacians, reveals to us the story of what happened just as he left Troy. "From Ilion, from Troy, the wind took me and drove me ashore at Ismarus by the Ciconians." Line 40. These Ciconians, if you remember back in the Iliad, Book 2, I believe at line 846, these are allies of the Trojans. These are their enemies. "I sacked their city and killed their people, and out of their city, taking their wives and many possessions, we shared them out, so that none might go cheated of his proper portion. There I was for the light foot in escaping, and urged it, but they were greatly foolish and would not listen. And then and there much wine was being drunk, and they slaughtered many sheep on the beach, and lumbering horn-curved cattle. But meanwhile the Ciconians went and summoned the other Ciconians, who were their neighbors living in the inland country, more numerous and better men, well skilled in fighting, men with horses, but knowing too, at need, the battle on foot. They came at early morning, like flowers in season or leaves, and the luck that came our way from Zeus was evil. to make us unfortunate, so we must have hard pains to suffer. Both sides stood and fought their battle there by the running ships, and with bronze-headed spears they cast at each other. And as long as it was early, and the sacred daylight increasing, so long we stood fast and fought them off, though there were more of them. When the sun had gone to the time for unyoking of cattle, then at last the Caconians turned the Achaeans back and beat them. And out of each ship, six of my strong-grieved companions were killed. But the rest of us fled away from death and destruction. From there, we sailed on further along, glad to have escaped death, but grieving still at heart for the loss of our dear companions. Even then I would not suffer the flight of my oar-swept vessels until a cry had been made three times for each of my wretched companions who died there in the plain, killed by the Caconians. This is Odysseus showing his piety. He is observing this ritual where you cry out for them three times, and he's doing this even though they can't get the bodies and bury them. The cloud-gathering Zeus drove the north wind against our vessels in a supernatural storm, and huddled under the cloud scuds land alike and the great water. Night sprang from heaven. The ships were swept along, yawning down the current. The violence, line 71, the violence of the wind ripped our sails into three and four pieces. These then, in fear of destruction, we took down and stowed in the ship's holds, and rowed them on ourselves until we had made the mainland. There, for 2 nights and 2 days together, we lay up, for pain and weariness together, eating our hearts out. But when the fair-haired dawn in her rounds brought on the third day, we, setting the masts upright and hoisting the white sails on them, sat still and let the wind and the steersmen hold them steady. And now I would have come home unscathed to the land of my fathers, but as I turned the hook of Malaya, this is on the southern tip of the Peloponnese, the sea and current and the north wind beat me off course and drove me on past Cythera, and of course spelled with a K or a C. 9 days then I was swept along by the force of the hostile winds on the fishy sea, but on the 10th day we landed in the country of the lotus eaters, who live on a flowering food. And it is here with the lotus eaters in line 84 that we leave the land of reality, most probably. Now Odysseus cannot be traced. All right, they're in the country of the lotus eaters, who live on a flowering food, line 85, and there we set foot on the mainland and fetched water, and my companions soon took their supper there by the fast ships. But after we had tasted of food and drink, then I sent some of my companions ahead, telling them to find out what men, eaters of bread, might live here in this country. I chose 2 men, line 90, and sent a third with them as a herald. My men went on and presently met the lotus eaters, nor did these lotus eaters have any thoughts of destroying our companions, but they only gave them lotus to taste of. But any of them who ate the honey-sweet fruit of lotus was unwilling to take any message back or to go away, but they wanted to stay there with the lotus-eating people, feeding on lotus, and forget the way home. I myself took these men back, weeping by force, to where the ships were, and put them aboard under the rowing benches and tied them fast, line 100, then gave the order to the rest of my eager companions to embark on the ships in haste, for fear someone else might taste of the lotus and forget the way home. And the men quickly went aboard and sat to the oarlocks, and sitting well in order, dashed the oars in the gray sea. Line 105. From there, grieving still at heart, we sailed on further along and reached the country of the lawless, outrageous Cyclops, who, putting all their trust in the immortal gods, neither plow with their hands nor plant anything, but all grows for them without seed planting, without cultivation, wheat and barley, and also the grapevines, which yield for them wine of strength, and it is Zeus's rain that waters it for them. These people have no institutions, no meetings for councils, all right, no agora. Rather, they make their habitations in caverns hollowed among the peaks of the high mountains, and each one is the law for his own wives and children and cares nothing about the others. This is one of those instances that we realize anything Poseidon gives birth to is generally outrageous, does not practice in the end, is probably a monster. And of course, Poseidon is the father, supposedly, in most instances of most stories, of the Cyclops. Line 116. There is a wooded island that spreads away from the harbor, neither close in to the land of the Cyclops, nor far out from it. Forested, wild goats beyond number breed there, for there's no coming and going of humankind to disturb them, nor are they visited by hunters who in the forest suffer hardships as they haunt the peaks of mountains. Neither again is it held by herded flocks nor farmers, but all its days, never plowed up and never planted, it goes without people and supports the bleating wild goats. Line 125. For the Cyclops have no ships with cheeks of vermilion, nor have they builders of ships among them. Who could have made them strong benched vessels? And these, if made, could have run them sailing to all varieties, cities of men, in the way that people cross the sea by means of ships and visit each other. And they could have made this island a strong settlement for them. For it is not a bad place at all. It could bear all crops in season. And there are meadowlands near the shores of the great sea, well watered and soft. There could be grapes grown there endlessly, and there is smooth land for plowing. Men could reap a full harvest always in season, line 135, since there is very rich subsoil. Also, there is an easy harbor, with no need for a hawser nor anchor stones to be thrown ashore, nor cables to make fast. One could just run ashore and wait for the time when the sailors' desire stirred them to go and the right winds were blowing. Line 140. Also, at the head of the harbor, there runs bright water, spring beneath rock, and there are black poplars growing around it. There we sailed ashore, and there was some god guiding us in through the gloom of the night. Nothing showed to look at, for there was a mist deep around the ships, and nor was there any moon showing in the sky, but she was under the clouds, and she was hidden. There was none of us there whose eye had spied out the island, and we never saw any long waves rolling in and breaking on the shore, but the first thing was when we beached the well-benched vessels. Then, after we had beached the ships, we took all the sails down, and we ourselves stepped out onto the break of the sea beach, and there we fell asleep and waited for the divine dawn. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, we made a tour about the island, admiring everything there, and the nymphs, the daughters of Zeus of Aegis, started the hill-roving goats our way for my companions to feast on. Line 156. At once we went and took from the ships curved bows and javelins with long sockets, and arranging ourselves in three divisions cast about, and the god granted us the game we longed for. Now there were 12 ships that went with me, and for each one 9 goats were portioned out, but I alone had 10 for my portion. So for the whole length of the day until the sun's setting, we sat there feasting on unlimited meat and sweet wine, for the red wine had not yet given out in the ships. There was still some left, for we had all taken away a great deal in storing jars when we stormed the Caconians' sacred citadel. We looked across at the land of the Cyclops, and they were nearby, and we saw their smoke and heard sheep and goats bleating. But when the sun went down and the sacred darkness came over, then we lay down to sleep along the break of the seashore. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, then I held an assembly and spoke forth before all. The rest of you, who are my eager companions, await here, while I, with my own ship and companions that are in it, go and find out about these people and learn what they are, whether they are savage and violent, line 175, and without justice, or hospitable to strangers, and with minds that are godly. So Odysseus tells his crews, my boat and I will go out and find out if these are barbarians, or if they practice the same Homeric, heroic type of codes that we do, for example, practicing Xenia especially. So speaking, I went aboard the ship and told my companions also to go aboard and to cast off the stern cables, and quickly they went aboard the ship and sat to the oarlocks. Line 180. And sitting well in order, dashed the oars in the gray sea. But when we had arrived at the place, which was nearby, there at the edge of the land we saw the cave, close to the water, high and overgrown with laurels. And in it were stabled great flocks, sheep and goats alike, and there was a fenced yard built around it with a high wall of grubbed-out boulders and tall pines and oaks with lofty foliage. Inside there lodged a monster of a man, who now was herding the flocks at a distance away alone, for he did not range with others, but stayed away by himself. His mind was lawless, line 190, and in truth he was a monstrous wonder made to behold, not like a man, an eater of bread, but more like a wooded peak of the high mountains seen standing away from the others. At that time, I told the rest of my eager companions to stay where they were beside the ship and guard it. Meanwhile, I, choosing out the 12 best men among my companions, went on, but I had with me a goatskin bottle of black wine, sweet wine given me by Maron, son of Euanthes and priest of Apollo, who bestrides Ismarus. He gave it because, respecting him with his wife and child, we saved them from harm. He made his dwelling among the trees of the sacred grove of Phoebus Apollo, and he gave me glorious presents. He gave me 7 talents of well-wrought gold, and he gave me a mixing bowl made all of silver, and gave along with it wine, drawing it off in storing jars, 12 in all. This was a sweet wine, unmixed, a divine drink, mine 205. No one of his servants or thralls that were in his household knew anything about it, but only himself and his dear wife and a single housekeeper. Whenever he drank this honey-sweet red wine, he would pour out enough to fill one cup, then 20 measures of water were added, and the mixing bowl gave off a sweet smell, magical. Then there would be no pleasure in holding off. This mention of adding 20 measures of water to 1 measure of wine means this is exceptional wine. Wine that, of course, the Phaeacians, Odysseus' audience, would never have heard of anything like this. Most wine would be diluted by 2 or 3. Of this wine, line 212, I filled a great wineskin full and took 2 provisions in my bag, for my proud heart had an idea that presently I would encounter a man who was endowed with great strength and wild, with no true knowledge of laws or any good customs. Lightly, we made our way to the cave, but we did not find him there. He was off herding on the range with his fat flocks. We went inside the cave and admired everything in it. Baskets were there, heavy with cheeses, and the pens crowded with lambs and kids. They had all been divided into separate groups, the firstlings in one place, and then the middle ones, the babies, again by themselves. And all his vessels, milk pails and pans, that he used for milking into, were running over with whey. From the start, my companion spoke to me and begged to take some of the cheeses, come back again, and the next time to drive the lambs and kids from their pens, and get back quickly to the ship again, and go sailing off across the salt water. But I would not listen to them. It would have been better their way, not until I could see him, see if he would give me presents. Line 230. My friends were to find the sight of him in no way lovely. There we built a fire and made sacrifice, and helping ourselves to the cheeses, we ate and sat waiting for him inside until he came home from his herding. He carried a heavy load of dried-out wood to make a fire for his dinner, and threw it down inside the cave, making a terrible crash. So in fear we scuttled away into the cave's corners. Next he drove into the wild cavern all from the fat flocks that he would milk, but he left all the male animals, billy goats and rams, outside in his yard with the deep fences. Next thing, line 240, he heaved up and set into position the huge doorstop, a massive thing. No 22 of the best 4-wheeled wagons could have taken that weight off the ground and carried it. Such a piece of sky-towering cliff that was, he set over his gateway. Next he sat down and milked his sheep and his bleating goats, each of them in order, and put lamb or kid under each one to suck, and then drew off half of the white milk and put it by in baskets made of wicker work, stored for cheeses, but let the other half stand in the milk pail so as to have it to help himself to and drink from, and it would serve for his supper. But after he had briskly done all his chores and finished, at last he lit the fire and saw us, and asked a question. "Strangers, who are you? From where do you come sailing over the watery way? Is it on some business, or are you recklessly roving as pirates do when they sail on the salt sea and venture their lives as they wander, bringing evil to alien people?" So he spoke, and the inward heart in us was broken in terror of the deep voice and for seeing him so monstrous. But even so I had words for an answer, and I said to him, "We are Achaeans coming from Troy, beaten off our true course by winds from every direction across the great gulf of the open sea, making for home by the wrong way on the wrong courses. So we have come. So it has pleased Zeus to arrange it, We claim we are of the following of the son of Atreus, Agamemnon, whose fame now is the greatest thing under heaven, such a city that he sacked and destroyed so many people. But now in turn we come to you and are suppliants at your knees, if you might give us a guest present, or otherwise some gift of great grace, for such is the right of strangers. Therefore respect the gods, O best of men. We are your suppliants, and Zeus, the guest god, who stands behind all strangers with honors due them, avenges any wrong toward strangers and suppliants. And so here Odysseus says he's looking for a gift, and of course Zeus, we know, is the god of the Nea. So I spoke, but he answered me in pitiless spirit, "Stranger, you are a simple fool, or come from far off when you tell me to avoid the wrath of the gods or fear them." Line 275. The Cyclops do not concern themselves over Zeus of the Aegis, nor any of the rest of the blessed gods, since we are far better than they, and for fear of the hate of Zeus I would not spare you or your companions either, if the fancy took me otherwise. But tell me, so I may know, where did you put your well-made ship when you came? Nearby or far off? So he spoke, trying me out, but I knew too much and was not deceived, but answered him in turn, and my words were crafty. Poseidon, shaker of the earth, has shattered my vessel. He drove it against the rocks on the outer coast of your country. Cracked on a cliff, it is gone. The wind on the sea took it. But I, with these you see, got away from sudden destruction. And so Odysseus lies to tell the Cyclops he has no ship. So I spoke, but he in pitiless spirit answered nothing, but sprang up and reached for my companions, caught up two together, and slapped them like killing puppies against the ground, and the brains ran out all over the floor, soaking the ground. And then he cut them up limb by limb and got supper ready, and like a lion reared in the hills without leaving anything, ate them, entrails, flesh, and the marrowy bones alike. We cried out aloud and held up our hands to Zeus, seeing the cruelty of what he did, but our hearts were helpless. But when the Cyclops had filled his enormous stomach, feeding on human flesh and drinking down milk unmixed with water, he lay down to sleep in the cave, sprawled out through his sheep. Then I took counsel with myself in my great-hearted spirit to go up close, line 300, drawing from beside my thigh the sharp sword and stab him in the chest, where the midriff joins on the liver, feeling for the place with my hand. But the second thought stayed me. For there we too would have perished away in sheer destruction, seeing that our hands could never have pushed from the lofty gate of the cave that ponderous boulder he had popped there. So mourning we waited, just as we were, for the divine dawn. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, he lit his fire, and then set about milking his glorious flocks, each of them in order, and put lamb or kid under each one. But after he had briskly done all his chores and finished, again he snatched up two men and prepared them for dinner. And when he had dined, drove his fat flocks out of the cavern, easily lifting off the great doorstone. But then he put it back again, like a man closing the lid on a quiver. Line 315. And so the Cyclops, whistling loudly, guided his fat flocks to the hills, leaving me there in the cave mumbling my black thoughts of how I might punish him, how Athena might give me that glory, the chaos of punishing him. And as I thought, this was the plan that seemed best to me. The Cyclops had lying there beside the pin a great bludgeon of olive wood, still green. He had cut it so that when it dried out he would carry it about, and we, looking at it, considered it to be about the size for the mast of a cargo-carrying broad black ship of 20 oars, which crosses the open sea. Such was the length of it, such the thickness, to judge by looking. I went up and chopped a length of about a fathom, and handed it over to my companions, and told them to shave it down, and they made it smooth, while I, standing by them, sharpened the point, then put it over the blaze of the fire to harden. Then I put it well away, and hid it under the ordure, which was all over the floor of the cave, much stuff lying about. Next I told the rest of the men to cast lots, to find out which of them must endure with me to take up the great beam and spin it in the Cyclops' eye when sweet sleep had come over him. The ones drew it, whom I myself would have wanted chosen, four men, and I myself was the fifth, and allotted with them. And of course, what this really means, if every time the Cyclops comes in, he grabs two men and eats them, he ate two, he ate another two, that leaves eight men plus Odysseus. When the Cyclops comes back, if Odysseus and four men take care of this plot, how many men are left? Two. Those who chose the lots are actually the ones who get to escape and go with Odysseus. The two who did not win will be the next meal. Line 335. With the evening, he came back again, herding his fleecy flocks, but drove all his fat flocks inside the wide cave at once, and did not leave any outside in the yard with the deep fence, whether he had some idea or whether a god so urged him. When he had heaved up and set in position the huge doorstop, next he sat down and started milking his sheep and his bleating goats, each of them in order, and put lamb or kid under each one. But after he had briskly done all his chores and finished, again he snatched up two men and prepared them for dinner. Line 345. Then, and now you realize that all that is left is Odysseus and four men. Then at last I, holding in my hands an ivory bowl full of the black wine, stood close up to the Cyclops and spoke out, "Here, Cyclops, have a drink of wine, now you have fed on human flesh, and see what kind of drink our ship carried inside her. I brought it for you, and it would have been your libation had you taken pity and sent me home, but I cannot suffer your rages. Cruel, how can any man come and visit you ever again, now you have done what has no sanction?" So I spoke, and he took it and drank it off, and was terribly pleased with the wine he drank, and questioned me again, saying, "Give me still more freely, and tell me your name straightway now, so I can give you a guest present to make you happy." The listener needs to remember that this particular wine that Odysseus has is only to be watered down 20 to 1, right? Only one part of water is added to 20 parts of this wine. This is extremely strong wine, and that is what he's giving to the Cyclops. "For the grain-giving land of the Cyclops also yields them," Cyclops still speaking, "also yields them wine of strength, and it is Zeus's rain that waters it for them. But this comes from where ambrosia and nectar flow in abundance." So the Cyclops is very impressed with their wine. Line 360. So he spoke, and I gave him the gleaming wine again. Three times I brought it to him and gave it to him. Three times he recklessly drained it. But when the wine had got into the brains of the Cyclops, then I spoke to him, and my words were full of beguilement. "Cyclops, you ask me for my famous name. I will tell you then, but you must give me a guest gift, as you have promised." "Nobody is my name. My father and mother call me Nobody, as do all the others who are my companions." Now, as a side note, Nobody can be said in Greek two ways, depending on the circumstances. You can say utis, or you can say metis, nobody. Odysseus calls himself utis, nobody, here in line 366. So I spoke, and he answered me in pitiless spirit, "Then I will eat nobody, utis, after his friends, and the others I will eat first, and that shall be my guest present to you." He spoke, and slumped away and fell on his back, and lay there with his thick neck crooked over on one side, and sleep, who subdues all, came on and captured him, and the wine gurgled up from his gullet with gobs of human meat. This was his drunken vomiting. Line 375. Then I shoved the beam underneath a deep bed of cinders, waiting for it to heat, and I spoke to all my companions in words of courage, so none should be in a panic and back out. But when the beam of olive, green as it was nearly at the point of catching fire and glowed terribly incandescent, then I brought it up close from the fire, and my friends about me stood fast. Some great divinity breathed courage into us. They seized the beam of olive, sharp at the end, and leaned on it into the eye, while I, from above, leaning my weight on it, twirled it, like a man with a brace and bit who bores into a ship timber, and his men from underneath, grasping the strap on either side, whirl it, and it bites resolutely deeper. So, seizing the fire-point hardened timber, we whirled it in his eye, and the blood boiled around the hot point, so that the blast and scorch of the burning ball singed all his eyebrows and eyelids, and the fire made the roots of his eye crackle. As when a man who works as a blacksmith plunges a screaming great axe blade or plane into cold water, treating it for temper, since this is the way that iron is made strong, this should say iron, even so Cyclops' eye sizzled about the beam of the olive. Line 395. He gave a horrible cry, and the rocks rattled to the sound, and we scuttled away in fear. He pulled the timber out of his eye, and it blubbered with plenty of blood. Then, when he had frantically taken it in his hands and thrown it away, he cried aloud to the other Cyclops, who live around him in their own caves along the windy pinnacles. They, hearing him, came swarming up from their various places, and stood around the cave and asked him what was his trouble. "Why, Polyphemus! What do you want with all this outcry through the immortal night and have made us all thus sleepless? Surely no mortal against your will can be driving your sleep off, your sheep off. Surely none can be killing you by force or treachery." Then, from inside the cave, strong Polyphemus answered, "Good friends, nobody." And he says, "Metis." Odysseus used Utis, and the Cyclops is saying Metis. And it just so happens that Metis, if you slur it all together, Metis means cunning intelligence, the smart one. Of course, Athena is Odysseus' patron goddess, and her mother was Metis. And so all of Homer's audience understands that Odysseus himself said, "My name is Nobody," and the Cyclops is saying, the smart one, or the guy with cunning intelligence. And yet, his other Cyclops friends will believe that he's saying nobody. So then, the others, speaking in winged words, gave him an answer. Line 410. "If alone as you are, none uses violence on you, why, there's no avoiding the sickness sent by great Zeus, if he's just sick. So you had better pray to your father, the Lord Poseidon." So they spoke as they went away, and the heart within me laughed over how my name and my perfect planning had fooled him. And here, name we know is Utis, and what the words that Latimer chose to translate, the Metis, he has translated as perfect planning. And my commentary suggests that it's better translated as cunning intelligence. Very interesting. So this is a joke that we in English can't get. Line 415. "But the Cyclops, groaning aloud and in the pain of his agony, felt with his hands and took the boulder out of the doorway and sat down in the entrance himself, spreading his arms wide to catch anyone who tried to get out with the sheep, hoping that I would be so guileless in my heart as to try this. But I was planning so that things would come out the best way, and trying to find some release from death for my companions and myself too, combining all my resource and treacheries, as with life at stake, for the great evil was very close to us. And as I thought, this was the plan that seemed best to me. And again, remember, Odysseus is telling the story of what happened when he left Troy, and he is telling this story to the Phaeacians." Line 425. "There were some male sheep, rams well-nourished, thick and fleecy, handsome and large, with a dark depth of a wool. Silently, I caught these and lashed them together with pliant willow withes, where the monstrous Cyclops, lawless of mind, had used to sleep. I had them in threes, and the one in the middle carried a man, while the other two went on each side, so guarding my friends. Three rams carried each man. But as for myself, there was one ram, far the finest of all the flock. This one I clasped around the back, snuggled under the wool of the belly, and stayed there still, and with a firm twist of the hands and enduring spirit clung fast to the glory of this fleece, unrelenting. So we grieved for the time and waited for the divine dawn. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, then the male sheep hastened out of the cave toward pasture. But the ewes were bleating all through the pens, unmilked, their udders ready to burst. Meanwhile, their master, suffering and in bitter pain, felt over the backs of all his sheep, standing up as they were, but in his guilelessness did not notice how my men were fastened under the breasts of his fleecy sheep. Last of all the flock, the ram went out of the doorway, loaded with his own fleece, and with me, and my close counsels. Then, feeling him, powerful Polyphemus spoke a word to him. "My dear old ram, why are you thus leaving the cave last of the sheep? Never in the old days were you left behind by the flock, but long striding, far ahead of the rest, would pasture on the tender bloom of the grass, be first at running rivers, and be eager always to lead the way first back to the sheepfold at evening. Now you are last of all. Perhaps you are grieving for your master's eye, which a bad man with his wicked companions put out after he had made my brain helpless with wine. This nobody, who I think has not yet got clear of destruction. If only you could think like us, and only be given a voice to tell me where he is skulking away from my anger, then surely he would be smashed against the floor and his brains go spattering all over the cave to make my heart lighter from the burden of all the evils this nittering nobody gave me." And as the Cyclops is speaking to the ram, of course, Odysseus is hanging underneath him. "So he spoke," line 461, "and sent the ram along from him outdoors, and when we had got a little way from the yard and the cavern, first I got myself loose from my ram, then set my companions free, and rapidly then, and with many a backward glance, we drove the long striding sheep, rich with fat, until we reached our ship." So you notice they don't even just run away empty-handed, they take the sheep with them. "And the sight of us who had escaped death was welcome to our companions, but they began to mourn for the others. Only I would not let them cry out, but with my brows nodded to each man and told them to be quick and to load the fleecy sheep on board our vessel and sail out on the salt water. Quickly they went aboard the ship and sat to the oarlocks, and sitting well in order, dashed to the oars in the gray sea. But when I was as far from land as a voice shouting carries, I called out aloud to the Cyclops, taunting him." Line 475. "Cyclops! In the end, it was no weak man's companions you were to eat by violence and force in your hollow cave, and your evil deeds were to catch up with you and be too strong for you, hard one, who dared to eat your own guests in your own house. So Zeus and the rest of the gods have punished you." Line 480. "So I spoke, and still more the heart in him was angered. He broke away the peak of a great mountain and let it fly and threw it in front of the dark, proud ship by only a little. It just failed the graze, the steering oar's edge, but the sea washed up in the splash as the stone went under. The tidal wave it made swept us suddenly back from the open sea to the mainland again and forced us on shore. Then I caught up in my hands the very long pole and pushed her clear again and urged my companions with words and nodding with my head to throw their weight on the oars and bring us out of the threatening evil. And they leaned on and rowed hard." You notice Odysseus is nodding and waving with his eyebrows. They are so close, and they've been washed right back to shore again from the wave of the mountaintop the Cyclops threw in. They don't want the Cyclops to hear them. Line 491. "But when we had cut through the sea to twice the previous distance, again I started to call to Cyclops, but my friends about me checked me, first one, then another speaking, trying to soothe me. 'Hard one, why are you trying once more to stir up this savage man, who just now threw his missile into the sea, forcing our ship to the land again, and we thought once more we were finished? And if he had heard a voice or any one of us speaking, he would have broken all our heads and our ship's timbers with a cast of a great jagged stone, so strong is his throwing.'" Line 500. "So they spoke, but could not persuade the great heart in me, but once again in the anger of my heart I cried to him, 'Cyclops, if any mortal man ever asks you who it was that inflicted upon your eye this shameful blinding, tell him that you were blinded by Odysseus, sacker of cities.'" The reader has to realize that the only way for Odysseus to get glory, the only way for him to get the kleos for this event, is to give the Cyclops Polyphemus his name. Line 505. "Laertes is his father, and he makes his home in Ithaca." So I spoke, and he groaned loud and answered me, saying, "Ah, now a prophecy spoken of old is come to completion. There used to be a man here, great and strong, and a prophet, Telemus, Eurymus's son, who for prophecy was preeminent and grew old as a prophet among the Cyclops." So even if these people do not practice hospitality, they did have a prophet. "This man told me how all this that has happened now must someday be accomplished, and how I must lose the sight of my eye at the hands of Odysseus. But always I was on the lookout for a man handsome and tall, with great endowment of strength on him, to come here. But now the end of it is that a little man, nittering, feeble, has taken away the sight of my eye, first making me helpless with wine. So come here, Odysseus. Let me give you a guest gift and urge the glorious shaker of the earth, Poseidon, to grant you conveyance home, for I am his son. He announces himself as my father. He himself will heal me if he will, but not any other one of the blessed gods, nor any man who is mortal." So he spoke, but I answered him again and said to him, "I only wish it were certain I could make you reft of spirit and life and send you to the house of Hades, as it is certain that not even the shaker of the earth will ever heal your eye for you." So I spoke, line 5-6. But he then called to the Lord Poseidon in prayer, reaching both arms up toward the starry heaven. "Hear me, Poseidon, who circle the earth, dark-haired. If truly I am your son and you acknowledge yourself as my father, grant that Odysseus, sacker of cities, son of Laertes, who makes his home in Ithaca, may never reach that home. But if it is decided that he shall see his own people, if his destiny is already set, and come home to his strong-founded house and to his own country, let him come late, in bad case, with the loss of all his companions, in someone else's ship, and find troubles in his own household." Polyphemus curses Odysseus with this curse, and of course, all of these things are going to come true. So he spoke in prayer, and the dark-haired god heard him. Then, for the second time, lifting a stone far greater, he whirled it and threw, leaning into the cast, his strength beyond measure, and the stone fell behind the dark, proud ship by only a little. Line 540. It just failed to graze the steering oar's edge. And the sea washed up in the splash as the stone went under. The tidal wave drove us along forward and forced us on to the island. But after we had so made the island, where all the rest of our strong-benched ships were waiting together, this is the island across from Polyphemus, and our companions were sitting about them grieving, having waited so long for us, making this point, we ran our ship on the sand and beached her, and we ourselves stepped out onto the break of the sea beach, and from the hollow ships, bringing out the flocks of the Cyclops, we shared them out, so none might go cheated of his proper portion. But for me alone, my strong-grieved companions accepted the ram, when the sheep were shared, and I sacrificed him on the sands to Zeus, dark-clouded son of Cronos, lord over all, and burned him the thighs. But he was not moved by my offerings, but still was pondering on a way how all my strong-benched ships, line 555, should be destroyed, and all my eager companions. So for the whole length of the day until the sun's setting, we sat there feasting on unlimited meat and sweet wine. But when the sun went down and the sacred darkness came over, then we lay down to sleep along the break of the seashore. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, then I urged on the rest of my companions and told them to go aboard their ships and to cast off the stern cables. And quickly they went aboard the ships and sat to the oarlocks and, sitting well in order, dashed their oars in the gray sea. Line 565. From there we sailed on further along, glad to have escaped death, but grieving still at heart for the loss of our dear companions. And thus ends Book 9.